Thanks to DigitalOcean for sponsoring Does Not Compute. DigitalOcean is the easiest cloud platform to run and scale your applications. From effortless administration tools to robust compute, storage, and networking services, DigitalOcean provides an all-in-one cloud platform to help developers and their teams save time while running and scaling their applications. DigitalOcean offers predictable and affordable pricing so you can leave those complex pricing structures behind. With DigitalOcean, you always know what your business will pay per month for industry-leading price performance with a flat pricing structure, and yes, that includes all of their global data center regions. I personally have been using DigitalOcean for all of my side projects, and I couldn't ask for anything more, and I'm for sure going to use them for my next app. If you're thinking the same thing, then you're in luck. You can get started today with a free $100 credit at do.co/doesnot. It only takes a few minutes to get up and running. Again, that's do.co/doesnot to receive $100 of credit towards a flexible and scaling hosting solution for your next application. Hey, Sean.
Hello, Rockwell, and welcome to another episode of Does Not Compute. I'm officially welcoming you into my recording booth. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
My virtual recording booth.
It's nice in here. White walls. Good choice.
Yeah. Everyone, the design trend seems to be remove all the contrast. So I figured, you know, just throwing a primer on the wall is just enough. And then maybe some like white marble on the floor was probably fine too. I feel like we're in one of those rooms in the Matrix towards the end.
The architect.
Yeah, the architect, right? There were just a bunch of like white rooms or something. I don't know. I'm screwing it up. But welcome to the show.
It looks flat. There's no drop shadows. So
yeah, I don't like drop shadows. So it's been a whirlwind of the week. I mean, like last time we recorded, we were talking about how it felt like it wasn't Tuesday or Monday. I can't even remember what day it was. That's what kind of week it's been. How's your week turned out?
Yeah, it's definitely been flying by. I've been living a little outside the software world this week, and we could talk more about that. But yeah, when you're just get your head down and suddenly you look up and it's Thursday and yeah, I don't know where the week went, man.
And you look up and it's Thursday and you don't want it to be Thursday yet because, right? That's the worst feeling, I think, because normally you're like, yeah, it's Thursday. It's almost Friday, meaning it's almost Saturday, which means that I can program non-work things, which isn't maybe great. You should take some time off. I should take some time off. I'm telling myself right now, you should take some time off on the weekends, but you think to yourself, oh, it's almost the weekend. But the worst feeling is when you think to yourself, oh no, it's almost the weekend. I have so much stuff that I wanted to get done. I had really grand plans for this week and none of them happened.
That's okay. It's good to take a step back from that stuff. Even if you're not actively thinking about work while you're away from it, coming back to it with fresh eyes always helps. I know I was really, really, really deep in something on last night. And it was like 5 or 6 o'clock. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to step away from it. And this morning, I just revisit again with fresh eyes and was quickly able to sort of solve what I was doing. So that, you know, you can't get too much in your own head. I think a break is good.
Yeah, that's one of those truisms about programming or problem solving, I think, is that if you ever get stuck or if you're spinning your wheels, walk away for a bit, go for a walk, go outside, hang upside down, do something.
It doesn't even make sense because, again, you're not really actively thinking about it. I don't know. I don't understand how or why that works.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I've heard some people talk about, so I can't remember the name of the book now. I think it was, I'll have to think about it and put it in the show notes. But I was reading a book that was talking about inspiration. It has something, the title of the book has the word creativity in it. And I remember the cover of the book was like white with reds and blues on it. But the book was about creativity and how people try to study creativity and inspiration, and it's almost impossible to actually get any sort of meaningful scientific data about it. But it was just a bunch of different stories about how people find inspiration and different things like that. And I think that sometimes doing something different, switching gears, causes you, maybe in your subconscious, you're still kind of churning on that problem. You're still thinking about it, but removing yourself from the context of it gives you a new perspective or allows your brain to actually think about it in ways that you're not actively controlling with your direct experiences. That could just be total BS, but maybe that's has something to do with it. I'm not sure. Again, I'll put that book in the show notes because it's been a while since I read it.
That's definitely what it feels like though. It's, yeah. I also find it's really nice to have work to come back to. Like if you leave yourself off at a good stopping point, or and you know where you have to go next. I actually kind of like that. You kind of have the carrot on the stick.
Yeah.
So you know, first thing Monday morning, okay, I just
get right into it and start working on where you left off to have a clear plan. I try to leave myself little nuggets, comments throughout the code, like to do, do this, do this, do this. And that way I can try to pick up a little breadcrumbs from where I left off.
I've got plenty of breadcrumbs in my code with to-dos. So many.
It's like empty pizza boxes.
Yeah, it's so we've been learning about, I guess the past year, I don't even know how long I've been working with Design Collective, the past maybe year and a half, almost 2 years. It should be 2 years at the end of the year. It's been kind of an exercise in learning pacing and an exercise in learning work, like pitching timeframes to my boss and kind of estimating how long things are going to take and how long it might take me to do something. And I don't know if it's a problem that a lot of people have. Obviously, estimation is hard. There are lots of books and talks about how it's nearly impossible to accurately estimate a software project. One of them I've read actually called Dreaming in Code. The whole book is about estimating gone wrong and how hard it is to estimate software. But I think more so, this has been maybe a year and a half of me learning that I too often say I could do that in a week when maybe I think it might take a week and a half or 2 weeks, but I say a week anyway for some reason. I don't know why I do it, but I do. And so the past, I don't know, a couple of weeks past, like Paul and I are having talks. And so we did this big project and we split the API from the client and we released a single page app. And we did that in a month. And both Paul and I were just talking to each other and we're like, we can't let each other keep doing this because yeah, we did it, but we also had to work more than we should have to make that happen. And that's something that I'm learning to get away from and trying to break the habit of pushing too much work onto myself, I guess. It's more self-imposed. It's not my boss saying, hey, this needs to be done sooner. It's me saying, I think I can do this in X amount of time.
Sure. And so how do you personally, or you maybe as the company, decide like what your deadlines are for projects? Because you're in control. You can decide when the deadline is and no one can tell you boo, right?
Yeah.
But like you said, you're kind of pushing yourself to reach that deadline. How do you like justify sticking to a deadline versus trying to bump it back a little bit more to maintain a more even workload?
I'm not sure, to be quite honest.
Okay.
In terms of justifying it, like, so if I pitch a time frame to my boss and then I tell her later, oh, it's going to take a week longer, she's always okay with that. And in fact, there's actually been more instances of she checks in on us and we're like, yeah, we're a little bit stressed out about this thing, but we're doing okay. And she was like, let's bump it back a week. Let's bump back the delivery a week or something. So the funny thing is there's no pressure on me to perform in that manner. It's just a learned habit. And I think a lot of that honestly comes from freelancing where I wasn't making much money. I wasn't charging much money. And so I just had to churn the work out to pay my bills. I was playing music. So it wasn't like working wasn't like all I did all the time, if that makes sense. So I would try to fill in as much time with work as I could so I could go do something else. If that, I don't even know if that changes my motivations, but that's kind of where I learned that habit was. It was a grind. Freelancing was a grind for sure.
Yeah, you try to compartmentalize it so you don't have to work those long hours.
Exactly.
When you maybe, you know, let it bleed into other things.
Yeah.
I think some people also just work better under pressure. You know, when crunch time comes, even if it's you're working longer hours and you're really stressed and tired, sometimes that's when you're the most productive, you know, for better or for worse, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know, that probably has something to do with it.
Maybe. I don't know. I think also part of it too is that there have been a number of articles and podcasts I've listened to and people I've talked to, and the whole thing about being like making an app and being a part of a small scale startup is just work hard, and that's the only way you're going to survive is work hard. And there's a certain counterculture against that. Obviously DHH kind of spearheads it and talks, you know, talking about how important sleep is and how you can't skip sleep. You can't skip taking care of yourself, eating right. You can't skip exercising because all of that degrades your work performance and the quality of your work. But for whatever reason, maybe it's just the atmosphere I've been in. You kind of feel like, oh, I have to keep pushing really hard. Otherwise, the business might not survive. And I think maybe that's something that's in the back of my head. And it's not like we're struggling. We're not struggling. We're not going out of business. We're not like struggling for money. But that idea is subconsciously there, I think. The faster we get things in, the sooner we'll be a sustainable business, I guess. But that's not true because adding another feature doesn't magically make you profitable. Adding, like shipping a feature that a couple of people asked for isn't going to just suddenly make all of your bills be paid, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know. I guess it really comes down to having accountability. And so for the year that I worked by myself, there was no one else to keep me accountable in sustainable timeframes and estimating projects in a sustainable way. Now that Paul's around, we're more often checking each other, or he's checking me, saying like, maybe we should ask for more time, or maybe we should tell them more time. And that's been helpful. So I was getting to the past couple of weeks, everything after this big single page launch, things have been a lot slower, and we've been productive. We've been rolling out lots of things, lots of good things, like I talked about earlier this week, but things have been slower and much more relaxed. It's a weird feeling.
Yeah. Slower, but still productive. That's a weird place to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't want to fall into the trap of, you know, once the business becomes a little bigger and more established, you don't want to fall into the sort of success hides problems kind of mentality where, okay, the business is doing great, we can kind of slack off now and maybe not work as hard. Or, you know, you just have to use that opportunity to either make it better or work on something new or work on stuff that you've been meaning to get to, right? You always got to find some drive to work on the product and not just let it sit.
Yeah, success hides problems. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that. I get the sentiment for sure. Like, it makes a lot of sense. And maybe that's something I'm fighting against too, because we're doing okay. We're growing, which is all you can ask for as a business, right? But I think part of it too is like empathy. So I know how much trouble the people that are paying for our platform have with technology. So it's always kind of, we're trying to push it to make it easier to use, more foolproof to use, more user-friendly, right? So along with programming, I spent a lot of time writing help documentation, writing help articles. And one of the big pushes that we made earlier this week was actually linking to specific help articles in specific places of our app. So if you're working on a flash sale and you don't know how to do something, the help article is within a click, like to that specific thing, not just to our help site, but to that specific flash sales article that says, here's how you do everything as a store owner for a flash sale. And we're trying really hard to keep empathy in the forefront of our mind, because if we're doing our jobs right, that means that the software is getting easier to use. It's more self-explanatory. And if that's the case and we're doing our job right, then the person on the other side using our software is hopefully making more money, because that's why they pay for our software, is because it helps them increase their bottom line too. Like that's the whole reason we exist, you know? And so I don't know if that is part of the psychological thing happening where I have to keep grinding because there's people that are struggling and their businesses are going under all the time. And so if we're successful in doing our job, those people won't lose their business.
Yeah, it's interesting when your what you spend your time on isn't actually not developing software. That's actually when some of the most interesting stuff happens, when you actually learn the most about your customers and who you're serving.
Yeah.
We just started doing live Facebook streams of Remote Ham Radio. So Ray, my partner, he has basically a Twitch setup. He's got a green screen behind him. He's got a boom mic. And then he shows the Remote Ham Radio console full screen and has, you know, great audio. And you can see exactly how he operates. And he's been doing this for the past couple weeks now, and it's awesome. Like, he gets on maybe once a day and just to see everybody's reactions, because we've been doing this for, you know, so many years, and you kind of get lost and you forget how magical it was when we first started.
Yeah.
And some people are still seeing this for the first time. And to see all the reactions from people, like, oh, I'm researching this. Oh, how do you do this? This is awesome. You know, where are you from? You know, all the like really basic questions, and seeing the people react to it is really, really, really cool. And it's fun. It's fun to watch too. I get a lot of enjoyment out of myself, so I can only imagine what it must be like for everyone else. And so that's one of those things where it's kind of a marketing tool more than anything, but it's also kind of education, because people are learning about the concept of remote operation in ham radio. That's just a fairly new thing in the hobby. So that's been really, really, really positive for us. And I, you know, if we had never tried it or had the time to do it, we wouldn't have never would have thought that. But I'm hoping that it helps draw in some new customers, because it's pretty compelling once you see it. It's hard to explain if you haven't, you know.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I would like to see that. It sounds interesting. We'll have to put a link to the show notes or something like that, or maybe I can tweet it.
Yeah, it's on the Remote Ham Radio page on Facebook. We'll put a link in the show notes. We're using Wirecast, which lets you stream to multiple services. So you, I think eventually we'll also have like Periscope and YouTube and other things. So you don't have to use Facebook.
Yeah, that's cool. So I want to kind of backtrack a little bit. I know we've been talking about some more of the soft side of things so far today. And I guess I didn't really answer your question. I think maybe to actually answer your question about how that stuff could get better in terms of estimating, I think that's just me getting better at estimating longer. But I wanted to backtrack. You mentioned something earlier. You said you've been somewhere not in the software development world. And I'm curious, where have you been?
I've actually been doing hardware stuff this past couple days, taking a break from web development land and diving into datasheet schematic board design land.
What?
Yeah, it's a whole thing. So with Remote Ham Radio, we use these third-party off-the-shelf interface boxes that someone else makes, and they're designed to support tons and tons of different configurations and radios. And what they do is they basically act as like an endpoint, so you can tunnel serial data through them, because all these radio devices use serial data. And it also has streaming audio directly in and out of it. It also does Morse code, so you can actually send and receive Morse code with these boxes with the right
interesting
timing and stuff. And that's how actually the very first thing we did when we started the business before we had WebRTC, we just had these standalone hardware boxes that customers had to buy. And they're expensive and they're really hard to set up, and they're just a pain in our butt to support. But they've worked well enough. But we need to take control of that now, because we can't keep supporting them. So few people use them, and they don't do exactly what we want. And they're expensive. And again, all the things I just said, they're a pain in the butt. So
yeah.
And the way we do things has just evolved over time. So we don't really need them anymore. With WebRTC, especially now, we don't need the streaming audio portion that the box handles for us.
Sure.
So that's kind of what I've been working on, this replacement box that's totally custom that does exactly what we want. And it's really, really challenging. I actually have a background in electrical engineering. That's my degree. So it's not totally out in the weeds for me.
Yeah.
But it's still challenging when it's been, you know, years since I've flexed those muscles.
Yeah, I can understand that, having to go back and do something you haven't done in a while, even though it's familiar, like you spent time there, it's still a little bit strange. It's funny because I was just talking to my buddy Drew, and I was saying how much I wish I brought a guitar on this trip, because it's been almost 3 months now and I haven't played. And It's strange because I don't remember, I started playing young, so I don't really remember what it's like to not play. But when I take extended breaks like that and I go back to it, it seems almost a little bit foreign. So it's not completely foreign, but it's a little bit foreign, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I've been working on. This box does a lot of different things. It's right now what the design is it's going to be basically, when you plug it in your computer, it's going to look like a 4-port USB hub, and then but all the three of those ports are actually internal to the box. You don't even plug in. So it's going to be two audio devices, a serial port interface, which itself has four serial ports off of it. And again, those are all internal.
Sure.
And then the fourth USB port, we're just going to put out the back for just general purpose use.
So the user, the owner of the box, wouldn't even see the other three ports?
Correctly. They're not exposed at all.
This stuff is so interesting to me because I've been tangential to it for a while. Like, I've been kind of peering from a distance. I have a friend back in Vermont who's building his own, he built his own 3D printer, and he's working on building his own CNC machine. So I'll go over to his house, and I'm like the programmer in town. So he'll like ask me to come over and check out his Node stuff, because he's running Node on some Pis and things like that. So we kind of bond over code, but what he's doing on the physical side, he's just kind of physically building this machine where he's 3D printing stuff for his house. I think that's so cool.
Yeah, that's cool. It's designing hardware is so different from software. Your whole mentality just shifts. The biggest difference is software, you're always kind of designing things to be as generic as possible. You want to design for change. You want to support future cases. You need to think about all these edge cases that you might have to support. Everything's very squishy, right? Nothing's ever done.
Sure.
When we're designing a physical board, like, it's not that you only get one shot at it. I mean, boards today are so cheap to produce. It does take some time to get them, but you can get them within a week. You can have a, if you pay for it, you can have a board turned for you in a week and shipped to you. It's not the end of the world, but it feels so final. You have to make sure that everything's right, and you can't have bugs. You can't patch it.
Right.
And everything is so specific. You have to find the specific parts that do the specific things that you want. You have to know how they're implemented. You have to know all the crap around it for to get it to work. And it's just so much knowledge. And the knowledge is not nearly as accessible as it is for, like, there's no Stack Overflow for board design. I mean, there is.
Really?
There literally is, but like it's not complete in the way that everyone just, you know, when you Google programming problem, the first thing you get is Stack Overflow, right? But if you Google some esoteric, why do I need these resistor for this chip? Like, you're not gonna find that. You just gotta read the data sheets until your eyes bleed.
That's interesting that it hasn't kind of been backported to the web, because there's a lot of people obviously out there that have that knowledge, they have that information, but it's just not in, like you're saying, it's not accessible. That's really interesting to me. I actually have lots of questions for you. So,
well, I just to point on that, I think it's because a lot of knowledge is just so locked up in businesses, right? This is there's hobbyist thing, you know, the hobbyists who do maker stuff, and there's lots of documentation for that, right? Anything Arduino related, you can find tons of resources for, but products that go into like commercial products, I feel like those are all, everything's just kind of kept internal and not really secret,
yeah,
but nobody's reaching outside for questions. There's no real public community for it. And if anyone knows of any, by the way, please let me know, because I would love to be able to find either a forum or a chat, Slack or Discord or something to just ask like little one-off questions or people are knowledgeable about that stuff, because I haven't found it yet.
Sort of a bespoke hardware community.
Yeah, it's got to be something.
Yeah, that's so interesting to me. Like, so thinking about the origins of Apple, thinking about like the origins of computer, like homebrew clubs and people hanging on garages and just sharing everything. It's really interesting to me that fast forward X number of years and everything's locked down. I mean, it makes sense from a business perspective, because certainly if you have these plans and they're very specific to your business and you have competitors, you would want to keep those locked up. You want to keep that tight and you want to keep that institutional knowledge tight. And that makes a lot of sense, but it's just interesting to think about the, just where things started at and where they're at now. It's just a very different place.
It's similar to how if you try to do any hobby .NET development, it's a lot better now than it used to be. But before, if you're doing .NET stuff, that was all, everything was corporate. And so the forums and stuff were just barren for that same reason, right? Everything's just kind of kept internal.
Yeah.
Versus an open source thing like Ruby or Python or anything else.
So you said that if you really wanted to, you could have a board turned around for you. Where do you even start? Do you just go and look? I assume there are just manufacturers out there and you send them the design and they send you the product?
Yeah, there's a lot of them are overseas and those ones are very, very cheap, but you know, the quality, it's the quality to match, right? You don't really know what you're going to get. You might have to order extra in case there's bad ones. If you want it done better, you can stay in the USA and pay a little more and also improve ship times. And that's just what I tend to do just for the convenience of it. I use OSH Park, which is really cool because still, again, I'm talking about pricey. It's still super, super cheap and you can get them super, super fast. And their boards are purple, which is really, really cool. But what they do is they will batch all the designs. So you basically pay per square inch, but when you submit your design, they'll check it and make sure everything's right. Automatically. And sometimes they'll actually send you private messages. They think something's wrong. Like they'll look at it first.
That's cool.
Yeah. And then what they'll do is they will send it to a fab, but it'll be tiled on a board with, you know, maybe 100 other people's boards, all designs, all tiled together.
Yeah.
And that's how they save money. So they print them all like that. And then they basically just cut them up for you.
Okay. So it's kind of like an old school model setup where all the pieces are kind of printed in one piece and then they're milled out a little bit. And then the piece that you use, you kind of chop out and then they send that to you. That's interesting.
That's exactly it. And so that's cool because you can make a board as big or small as you want. You're just paying per square inch. Who cares?
Sure.
And when you place the order or when the order goes to the fab, they send you an email and it's like, your order was placed along with 80 others. Isn't that cool?
Yeah. That, I don't know. It's interesting to me because it's a whole new world to me. I've never had to, like I said, I had an Arduino kit once that Paul lent me, but my roommate stole it. So I never got to play with it.
Yeah. It's very, very accessible for the hobbyist now in terms of getting things timely and cheaply, but the knowledge is daunting.
What is the tooling like? So I don't even know. So you're you're designing a piece of hardware. Is there even, what kind of chips do you use on that? What, like, do you run like a Pi in there? What kind of, do you have an operating system on that thing? How does that, I don't know anything about this stuff. I'm completely green here.
No, this is great. So in our particular thing, I actually am using an Arduino for some of the brains. That's just one piece of it though. Most of the thing is all like other integrated circuits. Like there's one chip that's just a USB audio chip, right? You just literally, it has, you know, four USB pins and you just plug it in and you get a microphone and speakers basically.
Sure.
That's just one integrated circuit with minimal supporting stuff around it. You got to give it power and stuff. But the way I kind of design things is I try to breadboard them out first. So I'll order small quantities and actually just literally like solder them together onto like a breadboard, which is like a little temporary thing. You can, you know, squeeze chips in and out of it, all through hole components, you know, the resistors and capacitors and stuff. And then I'm using Eagle, which is the Autodesk circuit design software. It also does the PCB layout. So basically you design the schematic in Eagle and then you create a board and it kind of links the schematic and the board together. So it knows exactly, you know, where all your wires should go and what the package sizes are, right? How big this particular component is. And then you place it on the board and do the board dimensions and drill holes and all this stuff. And that's, you just basically do everything in Eagle. It won't actually simulate the schematic. You have to just assume it works. You have to know what you're doing, but it will confirm that your schematic matches the board to confirm the design is correct.
Interesting. So there's not any sort of like linting setup where they're kind of catching, I guess, what you would call compile time errors. Like if you're right, if you're using the wrong capacitor or resistor or something, it's not going to say, hey, there's a problem here.
Right. There's other tools for that, simulation tools, like PSPICE and all that. But it will check to make sure that everything physically works. You know, you're not too close to the board edge. The components aren't too close together. The traces are the right width. Things aren't overlapping, right? It will perform those kind of checks.
Yeah. And I guess the breadboard, like you said, it's kind of a reusable thing. So you can reuse. I've seen like the one that I had was just a white block with a ton of holes on the top and you could just plug things into the holes. I guess that's like similar to, because I'm trying to equate software design and development. Like you said, you can't just Semver a thing and send it out the door. Yeah, you can't just like, oh, everyone download the update or anything like that because it's a physical piece. So there, like you're saying, there's some tools, you called it SPICE, I think. There's some tools that help you simulate your design. So I guess you just put in the specifications, like we're using this type of chip or this type of pin, and that would know the resistances and voltages and stuff like that to help you make sure that you're just not going to blow stuff up.
Yeah, basically. And you have to know how the simulator works too, because the simulator is not great. Like it'll, you know, garbage in, garbage out. If you set it up wrong, it's going to give you wrong results. So honestly, the best thing to do is really just build it. Just build a prototype and just poke at it with the multimeter and make sure everything's working. It's the easiest way. It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It all sounds very stressful to me.
It's quite challenging, but I kind of enjoy getting in the groove. And I got to say, when you actually have a finished board in your hands with all the parts on it and it works, that's you really don't get that feeling with software development, having a real physical thing.
I guess I could see how the feeling is different, right? Because if I'm thinking about my day-to-day development, I'm using a lot of packages that other people wrote and I'm just kind of plugging them in like Legos. So I'm taking the circuitry and plugging it into the breadboard, I guess.
In software, everything's a breadboard.
I'm trying to, it's so different. I guess, I don't know. It's interesting because there's a big trend. I think, I don't know if it's a huge trend, but it's just the circles that I'm kind of around. There seems to be a big woodworking trend among programmers. Or I'll notice that a lot of programmers will like, they'll have hobbies where they like to build things with their hands, not just kind of like stare at a TV or play games. Like I like to play games, but there's also a lot of hobbies that I notice that specifically programmers kind of gravitate towards, and it always usually ends up they're producing something out of a physical matter or medium.
Yeah, I'm actually in a Elixir Slack called Wood Chips and Bits.
Really?
And it's literally just a woodworking Slack for software developers. Like Chris McCord's in there. And because he's a big woodworker, he's doing some really cool stuff. Yeah, I think there's something to be said for just like we were talking about before, just stepping away from the programming stuff for a little bit. And as long as you're not, you know, cutting off your fingers, it's good to just rest your eyes and rest your brain and just make sawdust for an hour or two.
Yeah.
I have a little wood shop in my garage here, and I'm working on my deck right now, and got lots of little actually woodworking projects in the wings as well. But I think the appeal is just something get away from the computer when, you know, maybe programming used to be a hobby and now programming is your job. So you need a new hobby.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good way to say it. It's interesting because it's like, a lot of those hobbies I see are very similar. You're kind of working the same part of your brain, I feel like, the problem solving, the designing aspect of your brain. When you're woodworking, you're solving problems, you're designing how things work together. That's what I liked about shop class. I took a bunch of shop classes in high school, and I actually have a scar in my hand from, not a blade, luckily, but I had a friend that was using the table saw and he wasn't using it properly. We got kicked back and it threw a piece of wood, and I was standing where the wood was flying and it hit me in the hand.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, so I cut my hand open from a sailing piece of wood on a kickback. To this day, I don't like to use table saws because I'm paranoid about that.
Oh, they're terrifying.
Yeah.
You should be paranoid.
I should be paranoid. Yeah. It's just, yeah. But it seems like a lot of those hobbies kind of work the same part of your brain. For me, jujitsu is very similar. It's a very physical thing, but it's also, a lot of people kind of say it's like playing checkers or chess just with your body, because someone does something and you respond and they respond and you respond. So it's a creative thing, but it's also a critical thinking thing. So a lot of the style of thinking, I think, runs along the same vein of software development. It's just I'm using my body instead of my fingers to type on a keyboard.
Yeah. And really, when you get in the zone, you know, people talk about getting in the zone when you're doing development, and it's the same for any creative or any hobby that you're deep into. I think it's the same thing. You get in a state of mind where sort of time passes without you realizing it, and you get in a state of mind where you just totally lose track of time because you're so engrossed in what you're doing. That's so cool.
Yeah, it's hard to get there. It takes a while, especially with hobbies too, because if you want to get into that flow state, I think it's very similar to a flow state in programming, flow state in jujitsu. Actually, people call it, let's flow roll, where it's not like you're not going hard, you're not trying to strangle each other, you're just working on technique. So it's a very fluid thing. It's a very smooth thing. And that's kind of, to me, what flow state programming is like. And I guess it takes a while to get there, because when you just walk into a jujitsu gym, you're not going to be able to do that. You're not going to know what to do. You're not going to know how to respond to situations. And a lot of people, it's interesting, like the first few times rolling, they even start to hyperventilate a little bit. They breathe real, like, way too fast, which means you're just going to run out of breath. You're going to gas yourself out. They roll really hard. They're struggling the whole way, right? And you can't get into a flow state when you're doing that. And I guess like programming is very similar. If you're not familiar with the language or the framework and you're constantly having to stop what you're doing to look something up, it's kind of maybe a similar feeling, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good way to think about it. I hadn't heard that term before, but makes total sense when you say that.
Yeah, there used to be I can't remember what it was called, and I don't think I'll be able to find it, but I used to have a plugin for Sublime that actually tracked how much time on different languages I was spending, and it would make charts. I like charts, so it would just like make charts out of that. So it would say, oh, you spent X number of hours in Ruby, and you spent X number of hours in HTML, and it would try to like rank people. So if you spent X number of hours, it's going to say like you're better at X language.
Oh God.
It's going to kind of like rank you, right?
I don't know. That kind of stresses me out, knowing that something's tracking like that. I'd have that in the back of my mind. Like, maybe I'm doing too much Ruby today. I don't know.
Well, I use another app called Rescue Time. And I don't know if you've seen that. It's kind of a little bit different because it tracks everything that you do on your computer. So it'll track like, oh, today you used Sublime for 2 hours and you used iTerm for 3 hours and you visited github.com for 57 minutes. And so it just tracks everything, and it kind of tells you how productive you are. It gives you like a productivity score. And it's not that I'm trying to live my life by that score. I just like numbers and analytics. And so it allows you to set goals. So you can say, on the weekdays, I want to have less than 2 hours. That's way too much time, but like less than, say, 45 minutes of distracting time during the workday. So it just kind of helps me make sure I'm not hitting Twitter too much or going to YouTube too much, or it just helps me know that I'm staying on task and like no one's looking at this. My boss isn't like, let me see your charts. It's just for me to look at, but I like that stuff.
Yeah, mine would just be too much Reddit and Twitter.
Reddit and Twitter. Yeah. So you can actually, I think you can turn on focus mode, which will block stuff for you. So you can say, don't let me hit this site when focus mode is on, if you need something like that.
Just go into your host file and point reddit.com at localhost.
Yeah, you could
do
that.
Probably the best thing you could do.
You can certainly do that. Yeah. But I use that. And there's another app called Gyroscope, which is really cool. And it tracks lots of stuff. So you can have it connect to different accounts. So you can connect it to Fitbit, you can connect it to Rescue Time, you can connect it to Apple HealthKit. And so it'll track your steps, it'll track your like where you went. So you can generate, basically you just generate, it's a data viz app, basically. They just make it look cool. And so you can see, oh, this week I walked this far, and then you can see all the places you went for that week, and then you can see what your productivity was at different hours of the day. And so my new tab in Chrome is actually just a report from Gyroscope, so I can see like my productivity level and how many steps I've taken. So it helps me remember to like get up and go for a walk if I haven't taken enough steps, or if I've been screwing around, it kind of helps me like kick myself and say, oh, maybe I should do something productive.
That's cool. I mean, when you're your own boss, no one else is going to tell you to do that. So yeah. I guess that's a good kind of have those self checks.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not for everyone for sure, but I like that sort of stuff.
Well, speaking of being productive, we should probably get back to it.
Yeah. I haven't really done much today at all.
Well, what are you waiting for?
I needed to talk to you, but right now I just want to tell everyone to come hang out with us at our usual hangouts. That's Twitter. You can find me on Twitter at Sean Washbot. And if anyone knows how I can get Sean Wash, because they've been non-active since 2010, I believe, please let me know.
It's the worst.
Yeah. And you're Shrockwell on Twitter, right?
Yes. Yes, sir.
And we both also hang out on spectrum.chat, and we also hang out on different Slack. So you can probably find us in the Elixir Slack talking. I've been hanging out in the Absinthe channel a lot. We can talk about that maybe next episode.
Yeah, definitely want to hear what you got cooking up.
Hashtag GraphQL is coming. It's coming. But yeah, I just want to say thanks for hanging out with us, everyone. Thanks for listening. We like you said, we love feedback. Hit us up on Twitter. Hit us up. Email us if you really want to. I can't promise I'll respond because my inbox, but just reach out.
Yeah, thanks. And show notes will be available at dnc.show. All right, see you next week, Sean.
See ya. Thanks again to DigitalOcean for sponsoring today's episode. DigitalOcean really is the easiest cloud platform to run and scale your applications. Visit do.co/doesnot to sign up and receive a free $100 credit towards your next application. Again, that's a free $100 towards DigitalOcean's effortless administration tools, the robust compute, storage, and networking services, one-click app installs, and even monitoring and alerting services so you can sleep well knowing your application is running A-OK.